The content in this program is for informational purposes only. You should not construe any information or other material as investment, financial, tax, or other advice. The views expressed by the participants are solely their own. A participant may have taken or recommended any investment position discussed, but may close such position or alter its recommendation at any time without notice. Nothing contained in this program constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, endorsement, or offer to buy or sell any securities or other financial instruments in any jurisdiction. Please consult your own investment or financial advisor for advice related to all investment decisions. Don't forget to follow at Lead Lag Report on Twitter to join these conversations live. And check out the Lead Lag Report at www.leadlagreport.com. Use promo code PODCAST30 for 2 weeks free and 30% off to get access to award-winning research and anticipate stock market crashes, corrections, and bear markets. And now, on to our Lead Lag Live discussion hosted by Michael Guyon.
My name is Michael Guyot, publisher of the Lead Lag Report. Join me there is Daniel Lacaille. Daniel, it's been a while. I'm excited to catch up with you because a lot's been going on and maybe we'll have some interesting spirited debate here. But for those who are not familiar with you and your great work, introduce yourself. Who are you? What have you done throughout your career? What are you doing currently?
Thank you so much. Thank you, Michael, for inviting me to his chat. It's always a pleasure. Well, I'm a PhD economist. I'm a professor of macroeconomics at IE Business School. And I'm also chief economist at hedge fund Chessis, which also has a broker dealer and an asset manager side, and I manage one of the funds in that space. So really excited to be here and looking forward to the chat.
So I want to start off by asking a question which sounds a little strange. Where is the inflation that's still in the system coming from? And the reason I say that is I tend to think of things in terms of demand pull and cost push as sources of inflation, right? When I look at various intermarket relationships, the argument that it's coming from the demand pull side is not being validated by market prices, meaning retailer stocks have largely done nothing and actually are closer to making new lows. Consumer discretionary stocks in general haven't really kind of performed that well. So I don't really see it from stock market side, the excitement around continued consumer strength. And then I look at the cost push side on the commodity side. I just looked at a chart on copper and you look at oil. It doesn't seem like there's any real cost push inflationary pressure kicking in either on the commodity side, at least now. So what's driving current inflation dynamics? And is it possible that the market underneath the surface is sensing maybe disinflation or deflation to come?
Okay. We tend to look at the inflationary process from those viewpoints that you just mentioned, no? Whether there is a strong level of demand growth or a tightness in the supply side of commodity factors. However, inflation is not the increase in costs or the increase in prices, unit prices. Inflation is the increase in aggregate prices and the consistent and annualized increase in aggregate prices that can only come from monetary factors. So the reason why we continue to have elevated inflation is because if we think about the ways to contain inflation, there are three ways. Now, the first one obviously is to hike rates. That reduces the amount of growth in money in the system, but not the amount of money. The second is to reduce the amount of money in the system, which is not happening. Yeah, if you look at the proxy of global supply, the money supply globally, it is basically at $104 trillion, which is a very modest decrease from its all-time highs. The third one is that we see an aggregate demand reduction that would reduce the amount of credit, i.e. new units of currency being consumed in the system. That is happening, but it's happening only in the private sector. And the private sector in each of the developed economies is about 40 to 60% of the economy. But when the public sector, which is between 40 to 60% of the economy in most developed economies. It's not just not reducing the consumption of new units of currency, but it is actually increasing them. We have in the United States the so-called Anti-Inflation Act, which is a pro-inflation act, which basically means that the government is spending a lot more. So that is basically what is happening. What is happening is that the monetary aggregates are actually not reducing as fast as the indicators that you rightly mentioned would show. And yes, obviously there is a decline in monetary aggregates, but we have to include in those monetary aggregates the amount of money that the government is consuming through deficit spending. And that is showing us that basically, and that is consistent with a 3.5%, 4% inflation. So what we are actually seeing is an environment in which the traditional red flags for inflation, oil prices, way too high levels of consumption, house prices through the roof, etc. None of those are actually working in 2022, 2023. But we're forgetting the largest one of them all, which is the government. And when the government deficit is 9% of GDP, when the government debt increases by 1.3 trillion in an economy that has just increased its GDP by 414 billion in a year, then that's where your answer is.
It was obviously a leading question because, yeah, I've seen your posts around U.S. GDP hides weakness behind massive debt. I guess the question becomes, how long can that persist before there's some kind of other pushback, whether it's bond vigilantes, whatever that term means, or voters themselves basically saying, you know, the government worker now is making more money than me and I'm working harder than the government worker.
Well, that's a very interesting question. I think that ultimately the only way in which governments react to contraction in the monetary policy is when they start to see that the refinancing of their debt is much harder and much more expensive. So basically it's going to come from the bond market. And the bond market so far, although we've seen yields go significantly higher, the bond market so far remains relatively calm. And for a very simple reason, which is the same monetary reason, is that the amount of money in the system is way too high still, no? So what we could actually see is that this is prolonged for quite some time, but like all risks, they build slowly and they generate a big slump abruptly. And that is very likely to happen, is that what we will likely see is suddenly, well, the market says, oh, we're quite comfortable because the U.S. 10-year bond yield is not going above 5%. Well, let's see what happens if it goes to 6, no? And let's see what happens to the sudden stop in emerging economies with a 6% government, U.S. government bond yields, no? Even with a 5%, by the way, we're already starting to see the cracks, as you follow very well. No, we are starting to see the cracks. So, for example, it is virtually impossible for emerging economies to issue debt in U.S. dollars, and certainly not at the cost that they were accustomed to. And we're also seeing that the year of bonds that so many hailed way probably way too fast has become another negative year for sovereign bonds, no?
I guess the challenge is the real yield part of this, right? So, yeah, because everyone references the actual yield level, but real yield is what will determine, you know, how difficult that funding side is. So you could have, right? So if yields stay at, you know, where they are now, around 5%, but inflation in the private economy keeps dropping, the real yield is going to keep on rising. So that's where I think it gets to be problematic. You don't necessarily, I think, have to go to 6%. Usually the real yield to be higher.
Absolutely. If you see inflationary pressures drop and the 10-year yield of the government bond remains close to 5%, that certainly is the same thing as getting no change in the inflationary pressures yet the bond yield going to 6%. Yes, absolutely. I agree with you.
So this is something that I think most people would agree with. You know, no government's ever going to be able to pay off its debt. So the only real answer is to have negative real yield, negative real rates, so that the inflation rate is higher than what the rate that's being lent out. We're pretty far away from that. If you're not, say, you know, if you want the conspiracy theorists, but how does the government get back to a negative real rate?
Well, there are a number of ways. No, on the one hand, obviously, financial repression. No, once central banks return to solvency, let's remember that the most important thing that is happening right now generates very few headlines, which is that central banks are loss making. And that is hugely important in monetary terms, not because it means more inflation in the future. But the logical way to do it, to achieve negative real rates, would be by forcing the central banks to keep rates significantly below the inflation or the long-term inflation expectation level. No, that would be the easiest. That's not possible right now. However, there are other ways of achieving it, which is with much higher inflation than what we are currently estimating. If you look at the long-term inflation expectations, they have risen quite fast in the United States, but they remain at 3.3 exactly the figure right now, but I think that they're at 3.3%. Imagine that you bring it up to 4%. So that is another way. Ultimately, what we're living right now is not a repetition or a return of what happened in the 70s, but it rhymes. No, I think it was the CEO of Halliburton that said that history doesn't repeat, but rhymes. This is pretty much like that. No, governments are likely to impose a level of inflation that is significantly higher than the one that we would be used to in the past 10 years. And at the same time, try to maintain a level of easiness in monetary policy from central banks and become more similar to what the system was in the years before, in the 80s, 90s, more than the 70s.
Does it rhyme more with Europe? Because it seems like Europe, as Lagarde, is going to be more likely to cut rates, actually, you know, the first cut rates way before the Fed.
I would say so. I think that the ECB is caught between a rock and a hard place. The ECB was the first to implement negative nominal rates, which is an economic aberration. And it's been an absolute disaster because it didn't help governments to reduce their debts. Actually, they took the opportunity to borrow even more, particularly in the fiscally irresponsible countries. So the likelihood of the Europe area trying to replicate the Japanese system of yield curve control, of being in a constant financial repression mode that erodes real wages, real yields, and erodes also the growth in the economy, is very likely. The problem that the euro area has is that its trade surplus has shrunk quite rapidly. And obviously, that in order to have that kind of prolonged long-term financial repression that Japan has, you basically need to have a population of a very different nature than the one of the euro area, let alone the United States, complacent with the idea that your wages and your savings in real terms are going to be wiped out for some so-called social contract that never appears. No?
Yeah, and actually that does become an interesting transition to Japan and the elimination of the yield curve control side of things. First of all, just explain to the audience the significance of what's going on with the yen, the bond market, and inflation in Japan. I keep going back to, I think this is perhaps the most underappreciated risk. And I say that from the standpoint that I find it hard to believe that they can let the yen keep going the way it's going with wage inflation there not being anywhere near as high as the cost push inflation side from a currency adjustment standpoint.
Well, I completely agree that what is happening in Japan is the most important thing in terms of the overall perception of how money works. Because if you remember, Japan was like the poster child of the MMT defenders, the modern monetary theory defenders. He said, look, now if you're monetary sovereign, you can control the cost of borrowing without any problem. You actually can have a very stable currency. And on top of it all, have a government that spends like there's no tomorrow. No, obviously that sounds great. And it's perceived as something that can go on forever when people look at forever with the very limited time frame of very recent history. And what happened in the last years is, particularly in the last few years, is that it all, like those toys that my kids used to play with, in which you push one thing and another one jumps on the other side, is that everything crumbled on the currency side. The yen fell to a 40-year low. Inflation did appear after trying to create inflation forever. When did inflation appear? When the monetary balance of Japan stopped being an almost self-regurgitating money supply growth element where people basically were absorbing their own debt. And the inflow of US dollars into the Japanese economy, which is a huge exposure, started to crack. And that obviously made the yen collapse and collapse in a way that the Central Bank of Japan cannot admit. So what does the central bank have to do? It has to bring the level of the dam a little bit higher. And that means that instead of assuming this yield curve control by which the government cannot pay more than a certain percentage, they need to raise it. What do they try to achieve with that? More demands for yen, no? They try to achieve more inflow of capital buying yen and selling dollars, which is ultimately what we do when we purchase sovereign bonds in a non-US dollar denominated currency. So basically, that's what they're trying to achieve. Will they succeed? Not as long as the Federal Reserve continues in the current path. Why? Because you cannot basically just attract more capital into the yen at 2% yield when you have the US giving you 5%. And that is before you adjust the currency. No? So I think that it's, you know, basically what the Bank of Japan has shown to all of us, and the Bank of England as well, with the collapse of the pound after a very expansionary budget. What it's basically showing us is that there is no such thing as A, monetary sovereignty, and B, there is no such thing as a central bank's ability to disguise all fiscal imbalances without having a significant impact either on inflation or on the currency, which is at the end of the day, the same, no? So it's very difficult for the Bank of Japan to succeed with this policy, in my opinion.
So what are the implications on that in terms of global volatility? If they can't control, one thing is to say, well, the Fed's lost control of the bond market. Another thing is to say the BOJ's lost control. Yeah.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Hello, listeners. Michael Guyatt here from Lead Lag Live. Are you ready to take a deep dive into market trends, risk management, and investment strategies? Then you need the Lead Lag Report. Our in-depth analysis helps you understand the financial markets like never before. And guess what? We're giving you a chance to experience it at a discounted rate. Visit theleadlag.report/leadlaglive and get an exclusive 30% off on your subscription. Don't miss out. Level up your investment game with the Lead Lag Report. And now, back to our discussion.
Well, the BOJ has lost control of the yen. The Bank of England has lost control of the pound. And certainly, and I don't even think that it ever wanted to have control of the euro, but the ECB does not even have remotely any control of the euro. But I think that what the implications for volatility, I think, are quite significant is that what we're basically seeing is that instead of the trumpeted de-dollarization of the world, what we are actually seeing is a de-eurization, or if the word exists, I just created it, or a de-yenization of the world, is that the utilization of other currencies is falling. What that means for volatility is that volatility adjusted returns of emerging economies and non-dollar developed economies assets, both funds and equities, goes through the roof. Because the level of risk that you need to take to generate the same returns in quoted equities, quoted bonds in those markets, considering the inability of the central bank to provide that sense of stability, which manifests in the currency right now, but may manifest in, I don't know, a sovereign debt crisis in the euro area, maybe, we don't know, or a big problem in non-funded liabilities and pension funds in the UK or in Japan, no, both. At all of that ultimately is one way or another a manifestation of a massive monetary imbalance.
Do you get a sense that there's more of a risk of some kind of a global contagion from volatility coming out of Japan versus what's gone on with China? Because everyone tends to focus on China, but I don't know about you, but it seems like China is largely discounted and nobody's invested in China, or very few are invested in China.
Well, I think that it's very, let's say, typical of equity markets to focus on an emerging economy as the one that drives the volatility increase. But as much as we like that, it doesn't happen. The volatility increases always come from when the cracks appear in developed, allegedly stable and previously deemed as safe haven assets. So if we think about where the challenges may come from, they're certainly going to come from those assets in which pension funds or banks or investment funds put money, thinking that, you know, when there's a risk-off scenario, let's buy Japan, let's be long Japanese government bonds. And then the risk-off happens and the Japanese bond falls as much as the Italian one. No? That sends ripples all over the market. And yeah, I think that is likely to happen, just as it happened in 2022, when the Bank of Japan had to intervene three times and the Bank of England at the same time had to do something similar with a different perspective and with a different alleged catalyst. And I say alleged because the catalyst is the same, is the manifestation of an increase in risk built from a completely unrealistic view of low risk in those markets.
It seems to me like this is all sort of the perfect setup for gold to maybe break out and make new highs. I mean, I've noted that gold is more than just a trade or investment. It's also a warning. It's a signal. And there's been some interesting movement in the last several weeks. So yeah, almost like sudden spike in the price of gold. I'm sure you're seeing that too. Yeah. I want to get your thoughts on gold's movement. Again, I know it's short term. I know it can be noise, but I think it's worth paying attention to.
I think it's very worth paying attention to, because the moving gold prices these months is coming in an environment of complacency. It's not coming in an environment of, oh my God, there's a financial crisis. No. If you make a survey with investors, they always say that they're very conservative and very bearish. But in positioning, in real positioning, investors are not bearish in any shape or form at all. None whatsoever, in fact. So the move in gold says a number of things. First, how massively underweight the average portfolio manager is in gold. The second is that the problems that are manifesting all over the equity and bond markets are because of the impossibility to solve huge monetary imbalances with just a few rate hikes. And you think about it, everything that has happened in the market is the following. Now, if you have an inflation burst, everybody says, oh, it's because of the Ukraine war, oh, it's because of the supply chain disruptions, you name it, whatever it is, doesn't matter. So, oh, phenomenal. It's just an inflation burst. But next year, inflation goes down to 2%, central banks start to cut rates. No, they didn't. And no, they don't. And no, they don't again. And what happens in that process is that risk, instead of being, let's say, modified in terms of exposure, is actually exacerbated, is that investors see that the longest duration asset, technology stocks, go through the roof, but the remaining 493 stocks in the S&P 500 do nothing. Very much the same in most indices. One or two very large caps drive the entirety of the performance of stocks. The what was allegedly the trade of the year, sovereign bonds, works badly yet again. However, high yield performs adequately. No? So what we are basically seeing, if you think about it, is that what the market is doing is trying to accommodate the narrative to something that has absolutely nothing to do with that narrative. What is the narrative? The narrative is printing money and lowering rates and increasing massively the quantity of money in the system is not going to generate inflation or monetary imbalances, and therefore everything can be solved through monetary action. No, that's why nobody's paying attention to the fact that central banks are loss-making, because they don't care. But obviously, the longer the central bank takes to go and follow the narrative created in the past 10 years, the worse it is for investors. And the longer they take, and obviously because they're loss-making and because inflation is persisting, they're going to take even longer than people expected, then the losses mount. Margin calls become more expensive, etc. So that's why the trigger is not going to be China. With all of the challenges that China has, China is a more than discounted risk. The risks that are not discounted in any shape or form are the risks built in the assets that we perceive have no risk, which are sovereign bonds in developed economy.
That I do agree with. Let me just reset the room for the remaining minutes here. Everybody, please make sure you follow Daniel here on X. And if you want to come up and ask questions, click that bottom left mic request button. And as always, this will be in podcast under Lead Lag Live on all of your favorite platforms, Apple, YouTube, and Spotify. When you look at the entire environment from a macro perspective, what asset do you get a sense has the most undervaluation, that it looks to be the relatively cheapest?
We'll be back after a quick break.
Foodies unite with How You Dish. It's social media with a secret sauce. Food, the world's first network for food enthusiasts. How You Dish connects foodies across the world. Share kitchen tips and recipe hacks. Discover hidden gem food joints and street food. Find foodies like you. Connect, chat, and organize meetups. How You Dish makes it simple to connect through food anywhere in the world. So, how do you dish? Download How You Dish on the Apple App Store now.
Oh, I certainly think that if we look at all of the asset classes today, gold and precious metals are the cheapest. That for sure. Everything else are varying degrees of expansion. But I also think that we have to be extremely careful about the commodity complex, because as long as China remains in a weak recovery, and as long as the marginal buyer of those commodities remains relatively unstable, I always say that the Fed wins the geopolitical and the supply side narrative hangs down. So I think that that is certainly a fact. I personally think that the United States investment grade universe is quite attractive in terms of value. And I think that a few of technology names that are not large enough, but are disruptive technologies are also attractive. So basically, and people are going to find this surprising, but I think that the dollar is super cheap.
Super cheap. That's interesting.
And why is the dollar super cheap? If you think, what is the market? If you want to distill the market into one sentence, the market is one long short bet. Long, whatever you want. Bonds, equities, emerging economies, commodities, etc. Short the dollar, the carry trade. Okay, so when people look at whether a currency is expensive or cheap. What they tend to look at is at purchasing power parity. And they see the dollar is expensive in purchasing power parity. The euro is cheap in purchasing power parity. But that makes absolutely no sense. It's like going to a supermarket and thinking that the no one knows brand of cereals is extremely cheap relative to the Kellogg's one. Why? Because no one is paying attention to demand for currency. And adjusted for demand for currency, the euro demand is going down. The dollar demand is going up. And furthermore, the more that we see Japan, China, and others sell their treasury holdings in order to keep their currency relatively stable, the more the dependency on the US dollar in the next couple of years. So that's why I think it's obviously from a perspective of demand versus supply and in relative terms. Obviously, it's in relative.
Go to some of the audience for questions.
Thank you. Thank you. You're absolutely right. The traditional view of a 60-40 portfolio, bonds and equities, considering that in a downturn, bonds are going to be protecting you. And in an upturn, you're going to see a higher level of performance from equities, doesn't work. And doesn't work because of what I mentioned before, because of the extraordinary level of intervention from central banks of the past 10 years. So now, basically, there is positive correlation. So as you very well say, your Sharpe ratio comes down, and i.e. your generation of returns relative to what the market is doing, and also your ability to protect your portfolio changes. So how do I look at this? I always say that you have to look at it in a portfolio. You have to have beta and alpha generating assets, and you have to have defense. They have to have defense. Some commodities defend you. Some commodities defend you. Other commodities don't. Okay. So I wouldn't say commodities as an asset class. I would say some commodities. Would I think that, for example, oil is a good hedge in this environment? It may be because of geopolitical concerns and because of this environment. But for example, as Michael was saying before, commodities are not working and don't work are in your favor in a downturn. Aluminum, copper, nickel, iron ore, all of those. Huh? So I would separate between those that are actually, look at inflows of capital required in those commodities relative to the outflow coming from a weakening of the economy. So I would say industrial commodities, very careful. Energy commodities, and better placed in that environment. Not natural gas, obviously, because natural gas is seasonal, but energy commodities, I would say, can help decorrelate a portfolio in a way that bonds certainly can in this environment.
I think also the challenge is just how you get access, right? Because once you have, you know, effects like contango backwardation with commodities, which you can normally only access through futures, that just complicates any kind of thesis, I think, in general.
It's a great point. I would say that from an average invest standpoint, what you have to basically do is try to avoid being a commodity trader and simply have some exposure to an asset that is going to give you decorrelation through an ETF.
So I talk to a lot of asset allocators, advisors throughout the day, and yeah, I talk about my own strategies, but then, you know, I kind of just say broadly, you know, sometimes I wonder if all this analysis and thinking around markets even matters when you could just, you know, put your money in a treasury bill at, you know, 5% annualized and call it a day. Why isn't just the answer to everybody's concerns to just literally be in treasuries, short duration?
Well, because we have just outlined why, no? The governments in developed economies have broken all of the limits of responsible fiscal policy. Very high levels of debt and very elevated deficits. Okay. So no government as a monopoly issuer of currency and of the so-called lowest risk bond is going to give you saver real returns. Why? Because it's called financial repression for a reason. It's a transfer of wealth from savers to the indebted. And it's a policy. It's not, you know. So when did governments want to give you real positive returns so that you could put the savings in their debt? When the objective was to attract capital from savers to a fiscal policy that was directly linked to the economic cycle. So governments in periods of growth would reduce their expenditure, would cut taxes, and reduce the size of government. In periods of crisis, they therefore had some saving to help the economy get back into shape with what is called the automatic stabilized sign. What's the problem? The problem starts when governments go from being the provider of financing of last resort to the providers of financing of first resort. So in periods of growth, the government comes and says, now it's time to borrow. No, you must remember, many of you, that famous article from Krugman with the economy growing at 3%. It's time to borrow. No, it's not time to borrow. And in times of crisis, it's time to borrow as well. So when the mindset of the policymakers is that they are the solution to the growth and the recession problem, the saver is not their friend, but their enemy. And because they know by now that no matter what yield, or no matter what yield, no, but they know by now that there is a minimum level of demand for their paper that is going to be absorbed by the market because they have to. You know how many pension funds need to buy an issuance of sovereign bonds because it's in their mandate, as well as the central bank. And remember, fiscal and monetary policy are the same thing. So when fiscal policy cannot respond to the economic cycle and actually goes completely against the economic cycle in growth and in recession times, monetary policy is always going to end up working against the holder of sovereign bonds. So the traditional view of Warren Buffett that you just own treasuries and a few stocks and close your eyes and enjoy your money doesn't happen, because in real terms, you are getting poorer and poorer.
So what you're saying is what I've been saying the entire time for the last several months, which is that we're all fucked. That sounds like
that. Allow me just to say one thing. Just not that we're all fucked, but it's inevitable that when we have seen and witnessed the building of a tsunami, and everybody was happy because the waves did not catch them, we need to understand that we may not die, but we're going to flood. That is a fact. And that is either going to come in higher inflation or negative returns of sovereign bonds for a very long period of time, or in which is basically destruction of the amount of money issued in the system. By the way, when the Fed talks about soft landing, what they're talking about is your portfolio will be worth 20% less, but unemployment will remain around 4%. Okay? That is the soft landing. That means reducing the amount of money in the system from 104 trillion to 100 trillion. Without, let's say, the real economy suffering more than it should. And again, let's remember that the entire market is in relative terms. So the people think, oh, well, that means that the US government can do whatever it wants. No, it cannot do whatever it wants. But in relative terms, compared to the rest of the quoted currencies and assets, that is a big difference. So what we're not seeing is the de-dollarization. What we are seeing is a re dollarization.
So, Daniel, I always go back to path matters more than prediction. So you sit from the standpoint similar to me. Do you consider this one of the more challenging types of environments to try to allocate based on the way the different paths are playing out? Because, you know, yes, it's true. Clearly, if anybody was in the dollar, that was the most obvious with hindsight trend to play, although nobody would have thought that the dollar would have been the best inflation hedge, right, when all this started. Yeah. But talk about it from sort of a portfolio management perspective, you know, how challenging this environment has been.
Oh, huge. Also, because from the perspective of discussing with clients, it's incredibly difficult, even if you want to be overweight dollar and gold, because nobody wants to like the idea. I think that this is the most challenging thing of it all. No? Obviously, if anybody would have told us that the dollar was the best hedge against a sovereign bond and bond market decline, it is certainly a surprise. Even being overweight the US dollar, being long US dollar as I was, no? But the other thing that I think is very challenging is the discrepancy between the headlines that we read and what actually happens in portfolios. The fact that only 5, 6, 7 stocks account for the entirety of the performance of the S&P 500. The fact that the Russell 2000 is doing horribly, despite the idea that the United States equities are doing phenomenal. All those things make it very difficult for an investor. And there's also the added problem of we have had by now, it is two generations of traders that have only seen financial repression, negative reduction in rates, and increase in money supply. So it's very difficult for people to understand that maybe all of that is over, at least in the way in which we expected it to be, in multiple expansion generation terms. So it is very difficult. I think that is going to, and it's going to remain exceedingly difficult, because a lot of people are trying to bet on when the Fed is going to pivot in order to continue to be exposed to the same type of assets. And I think that there are going to be a number of assets that we have historically accepted to hold that we need to say, you know what? We don't want any of that for our clients in the next 10 years. Easy.
Yeah. And I think realistically, you're only going to Fed pivot when credit stress tells you you're going to get a Fed pivot. Right?
Absolutely.
And I keep going back to, even if the stock market were to crash, and again, I maintain that we're just from an intermarket perspective in a short-term, very high-risk setup here. But even if the stock market crashes, the stock market crashes, but credit spreads stay tight, they're not going to save the stock market because they care about saving default risk getting out of control.
And also because people don't want to understand what a soft landing means. A soft landing for a monetary authority means that there will be a huge reduction in the quantity of money in the system without massive implications in the employment and in the what we call the real economy. How do you achieve that? Only with a huge market correction, which means that the quantity of money is reduced by a price. So when Jerome Powell and the Fed is talking about a soft landing, they are talking about equities correction with, as you have very well mentioned, with spreads remaining relatively stable and therefore credit conditions remaining relatively stable as well.
Yeah. It's just funny to me because I don't know if people really understand the difference between a bond sell-off like what we've seen that's duration-driven and which is really a shift in the curve, right? Versus, you know, what is a more traditional bond sell-off, which is credit spreads. I'm still bearish on bonds, but I'm bearish on bonds because of credit risk, which I think is why treasuries would, you know, get back that kind of flight to safety behavior.
Oh, treasuries relative to other sovereign bonds may. Yes, absolutely. Because of the sudden stop in emerging economies, they may. But in themselves, I find it very difficult to believe that a government that is unable to reduce its deficit below the structural deficit of the United States is now at 6% of GDP. So we need to look at it from the perspective of what that means, short term and long term. Short term, it means that the limited supply of dollars is going to be hugely, mostly consumed internally. And therefore, that there is a flight to out of emerging economies, out of developed non-dollar economies to the dollar. Absolute. Long term, it means that the only thing that the government can do is make those 15 trillions in 10 years disappear, vanish, gone. And that's your bonds.
Daniel, for those who want to track more of your thoughts, your work, where would you point them to? And maybe touch on the books and where they can buy them.
You can buy my books at any of the traditional outlets. If you want my views on the monetary system, Escape from the Central Bank Trap is one of them. Freedom or Equality is more about the values and the system that we are leading to. And The Energy World is Flat is about the commodities situation that we have discussed throughout the chat with the monetary as well. And Life in the Financial Markets is the first book I wrote, which is about my experience throughout the financial crisis and a little bit further.
Everybody, please give Daniel a follow here. As you tell, wildly knowledgeable, great way in terms of the way he communicates things. I think it was a great conversation. Again, I will have this as a podcast in a couple of days here. And hopefully I will see you all tomorrow when I have another space or two, I think, coming up. Thank you, Daniel. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it. Thank you for your questions and have a great day, everyone. Bye-bye.
The content in this program is for informational purposes only. You should not construe any information or other material as investment, financial, tax, or other advice. The views expressed by the participants are solely their own. A participant may have taken or recommended any investment position discussed, but may close such position or alter its recommendation at any time without notice. Nothing contained in this program constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, endorsement, or offer to buy or sell any securities or other financial instruments in any jurisdiction. Please consult your own investment or financial advisor for advice related to all investment decisions. Don't forget to follow at LeadLag Report on X, Instagram, Threads, and YouTube, and check out the LeadLag Report at www.leadlagreport.com. Use promo code PODCAST30 for 2 weeks free and 30% off to get access to award-winning research and anticipate stock market crashes, corrections, and bear markets.